for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama has made an overhaul of this country's health care one of his top priorities. Primary care physicians are a key component of the system, but they find their jobs increasingly undervalued in the marketplace. Joining me to talk about the pressures facing primary care physicians and their role in possible changes to U.S. health care, Dr. Atul Grover of the Association of American Medical Colleges, Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen. He's professor of medicine and health policy at George Washington University. And joining us by phone from Atlanta, Dr. Walker Ray. He's vice president for the Physicians Foundation and a former pediatrician. I'm sure many of you have comments about primary care, your own physical situation, how you interact with your primary care physician. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Thank you for letting me be here.
Indeed. Dr. Mullen, let me start with you. You've called the pressures facing primary care doctors a sleeper issue in this health care debate. How come?
Well, first, a word about primary care doctors. Generally, we're talking about family physicians, general internists, and general pediatricians. In all the domains of primary care practice, over the last 40 years, there's a lot more that we can do. We can control diabetes very tightly and have much better outcomes. We can prevent many diseases with vaccinations and careful monitoring that we couldn't before. So primary care has become a very vital part of maintaining good health for the individual and society. But over the last decade or two, as prices or costs have gone up and what might be called the monetarizing of health care, that is, everything is accounted for by minute and dollar, the pressures on those delivering primary care in terms of how many patients they have to see over what period of time have risen. At the same time, their recompense, whether it's salaried or private practice, based on insurance rates, has remained at the bottom of the physician scale. So the combination of high pressure, low reward, and I must say low status in many sectors, has conspired to put primary care, which is critical to the well-being of any health system and any individual, in tough shape in America.
Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, he's professor of public health and health services at the George Washington University. Turning to you, Dr. Grover, what about this status? What is it about primary care physicians and their work that has somehow devalued their status?
Well, I think a lot of this has to do with the way that we pay for care in the nation. And so societal value, relative value, or status within the medical profession is often going to be reinforced or reflected by the amount of compensation that people are paid for what they do. And so when primary care physicians and others who really do a lot of cognitive work, that is, they work really with people, think through things, intellectual challenges, managing diseases, when that is paid at a lower level than procedural work in many cases, that's reflected in their overall income, particularly when, as our patients grow older, more complex, have multiple chronic conditions, it's very difficult to become more, quote-unquote, efficient and see them as if they were widgets.
So you're saying if I go in and simply talk with my doctor for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, that is not going to remunerate her as greatly as it would if she provided some particular procedure.
That's absolutely right. And remember that she's also got to be worried about having enough volume to sustain the practice financially, and that 15 minutes gets squeezed down more and more with more time devoted to paperwork, trying to contact insurance companies, deal with reimbursement, follow up with patients, and it's a real squeeze on doctors and patients alike.
Dr. Atul Grover, he of the Association of American Medical Colleges. Dr. Ray, as a pediatrician yourself, what do you see as the primary loss of income, of procedural elevation as far as primary care doctors are concerned? And do you believe there is a shortage?
There's definitely, in my opinion, a shortage. The Physicians Foundation, which is the public charity 501c3 organization that I represent, did a survey of every primary care physician in the United States in 2008. We sent out 270,000 survey instruments to every primary care physician that we had in our database who was actively practicing. Now, for our purposes, primary care was defined as family practice, general internal medicine, pediatrics, and because so many OBGYNs are forced by necessity to give primary care, we also surveyed them. 78% of our respondents said that there was a physician shortage. This is something that is much higher than has been in the past because physicians, for one reason or another, perhaps competitive reasons, have not been quick to acknowledge in such numbers that there is a shortage of physicians. We ask, how difficult is it for you to recruit a physician to join your practice? And 90% said it was very difficult or moderately difficult. Only 11% said it was not difficult. So I do think that there is general consensus that there is a shortage of physicians now, particularly in primary care. If you think about it, we've been training the same number of physicians for the last 10 years because since the balanced budget amendment of 1997, residency slots have been fixed. The population has continued to grow. As our other contributors have pointed out, there are more and more things that primary care physicians can do. The demand for services continues to increase, and fewer medical students are choosing primary care.
Dr. Walker Ray, he's vice president for the Physicians Foundation. He retired after 38 years as a pediatrician in Atlanta. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And remember, you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. I want to pick up on that last statement of Dr. Ray's, Dr. Mullen. Why is it that so many fewer individuals going to medical school are choosing primary care?
This is a very good and very tough question. The circumstances we've described are read or can be read by medical students. That is, they'll make less money. They, in many cases, will work harder, and they often will work more difficult hours. There's a trend in young people today, and certainly in young medical students or in young physicians, to opt for what are called lifestyle specialties. And what that means is specialties where people can predict their hours. Radiology, for instance, anesthesiology, emergency medicine, dermatology. You can, whether it's a 9-to-5 or it's a shift work, there's bounds to it. When you're doing primary care, and to be sure other specialties such as surgery, you have to be on call a fair amount of the time, and that's hard on personal and family life. This is something that physicians have done for decades, probably centuries, to some extent always, but today there is a disinclination among many to do that. And that, of course, in all of the primary care disciplines, that kind of 24/7 responsibility is out there and has to be worked into family life. And that being the case, as well as the financial situation, many young folks are looking elsewhere. And then finally, just quickly, it might be said that the environment in which students are trained, the medical schools and the teaching hospitals, are very engaged with generation of new knowledge. There is a proclivity to have faculty that are specialists and subspecialists, and reductionism, specialism, is valued. These values of good care, competent care, broad-based care are not always as manifest in the training settings as they might be. So people are not mentored as they might be.
Dr. Grover.
I think Dr. Mullen absolutely has a point about mentoring, and I think the rest of his comments really do ring true. The literature, though, about why people choose primary care or other specialties is pretty complex. The GAO did a report on this just a couple of months ago, looking in particular at student debt. And, you know, we represent medical schools as well as teaching hospitals and see this from both ends. Both people coming into school, we survey them as they go in, as they come out. Debt certainly plays a role, but it is not the major factor. More than anything else, graduating medical students are looking for something that matches their interests and what they want to do all day. We all look for something that pleases us professionally. And for some reason, for multiple reasons, they are choosing other fields. Now, the other thing that's very important to them is job security. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now. These are people who put a lot of time and energy into their education and training and are potentially faced with an uncertain career in primary care once they see all of the other health professionals engaged in delivering much of that care, uncertainty about future reimbursement. And perhaps, you know, the most interesting thing is that these physicians, when they come out, are actually trying to navigate a system that they don't know what it's going to be like in a couple of years.
Dr. Atul Grover, the Association of American Medical Colleges. When we come back, we'll talk more. Take your calls, your email. Stay with us. Welcome back. We were talking about primary care physicians, how they fit into the Obama plan to reorganize healthcare, and what the future of primary care physicians in this country may be. I have two guests in the studio, Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen of George Washington University and Dr. Atul Grover of the Association of American Medical Colleges. On the line with us from Atlanta is Dr. Walker Ray. For 38 years, he served as a pediatrician in Atlanta. He is now vice president for the Physicians Foundation. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We've talked a little about the debt into which young medical students go, the debt that ultimately has to be paid off in their practice. Dr. Ray, do you have any figures on the average income of primary care physicians?
Yes, and this depends on which source that you go to, but it is somewhere between 125 and 150 to 175 thousand, at this point, which is about half of what specialists make. I want to focus on, if I could, just a minute,
sure,
on the medical practice environment right now, because primary care physicians consider their environment very difficult. On our survey by the Physicians Foundation, we asked them, what do they find most satisfying about medical practice? And not surprising, almost 50% said the most satisfying thing about medical practice is patient relationships and spending time with their patients. Other issues like intellectual stimulation and collegial professional relationships were far behind spending time with their patients. They are involved, as we have talked about, in a perverse reimbursement scheme where primary care doctors have to work harder and harder and faster to see more and more patients, and this is intensely dissatisfying for physicians as well as patients. I cringe when I hear patients say, I had to wait an hour or 2 hours in the doctor's office, because I know that that physician is also unhappy as fast as he or she is having to work to move these patients through to meet the overhead. So the medical practice environment right now, doctors feel devalued. Their morale is low. They no longer feel like they have a rewarding practice. For instance, in our survey, we asked about the morale of colleagues, and only 5% of respondents said that the morale of their colleagues was positive. We asked them how satisfied they were with their practice. 66% said that they were less satisfied or unsatisfied over the last 2 or 3 years.
All right.
We asked them if they had their career to do over again, what would they do as far as choosing primary care? And only 1 in 4 would choose primary care again, and 1 in 4, 27%, would choose not to be a physician. So the point is that the medical care practice environment is getting to be so uncomfortable and so devalued, and word is getting back to the medical students. So it's not just that we have to encourage more medical students to go into primary care. We've got to fix the problems within the practice environment to keep the physicians that we have there.
Here is an email from Marina, who says, as I understand it, about 40% of all emergency room cases are not actual emergencies and could be taken care of by a primary care physician. Emergency care is very expensive, but at the same time, many people have no choice but to go to the emergency room because they would have to wait weeks before they can see their primary care doctor, while insurance restrictions keep them from going to see another doctor. I believe one solution could be more community treatment centers. One recently opened up in my community. I was able to receive care on short notice rather than go to the emergency room in a hospital. And that brings us to this issue of the possibility of a medical home. Dr. Grover, how do you read this idea of medical homes?
Well, I think the medical home is an idea whose time has really come. We have talked for years about the functions of primary care in terms of it being continuous, relationship-focused, having a really comprehensive approach to the patient and their family, taking care of almost all of their needs.
How would it work?
Well, I think in the current iteration, this is an idea that's been around for 40 years. It was first coined by the Academy of Pediatrics in 1967. And really in the 1990s, as we became more concerned about the status of primary care, you'll remember a similar conversation around managed care back then. I would say that the big distinction between the conversation we're having now and the one we had in the 1990s is that we are less focused, hopefully, on who provides the care rather than focusing on the functions of good care and really seeing, instead of having a gatekeeper, a gateway, somebody that helps you navigate a system in which people often feel homeless.
Dr. Mullen?
The organization of practice in general, and certainly in primary care, is terribly important. Most primary care physicians still function either in solo practice or small groupings, three or four practitioners. The idea of a medical home would be an organized practice that had not only physicians, but nurse practitioners, physician assistants, perhaps nurse midwives, and other mental health workers, so that it was a one-stop shop for all of primary care needs. Far more coordinated, health information technology enabled, and geared to deal with what is the prevalent set of problems today in healthcare, and that's chronic illness. It requires regular, periodic visits with good follow-through, excellent information management. What were your lab tests last time? What are they today? When we sent you to the specialist, what did he or she say? And the electronic letter is back with you, et cetera. So it's a highly organized home that values care coordination. That's the key term. And pays for care coordination.
Dr. Bray, how much support is there out there for this concept?
Well, I think that the two contributors before me have articulated the concept very well. As a young pediatrician in the late 1960s and early 70s, I remember being very interested and supportive of the medical home concept, and I'm a little bit disappointed that not more has happened over the last 40 years. However, going back to my previous comment about the toxicity and the stress within the medical practice environment, to rework the workflow within your office and to become qualified as a medical home puts a lot of stress on a physician's office, and physicians are going to need a lot of help to have this come about, because otherwise they're just going to throw up their hands. They're at this point anyway. And if more criteria and obligations are piled on without appropriate support and infrastructure, then we've got a problem.
Then the question becomes, back to the beginning, what can be done to encourage more young people to go into primary care? Dr. Grover.
I think, again, the history of the 1990s is instructive, that we have tried within medical education to encourage people to go into primary care, give them better experiences for decades. The one time when we've actually seen movement on increasing interest in primary care, less interest in subspecialization, was in the period of 1994 to 1998. So what happened during that period? There was a clear market signal sent to medical students. I was one of them. And we were essentially told the future is going to be heavily revolving around primary care and its role in the healthcare system. If you want to be employed, and in particular if you want a better income than many subspecialists will earn, you should go into primary care. And in fact, we saw huge drop-offs in interest in things like anesthesia, cardiology, radiology, but we talked a lot about a system that we thought would materialize in this country that never happened. But it's clear that it was the market signals more than anything else that really encouraged people to go into primary care. And overall, you know, we have shortages of physicians across the board. So if we don't ease physician shortages in general, it's still going to make it harder to get people interested in primary care.
And what about the debt that the students, no matter what kind of specialty they move toward, what about the debt that students incur just to become a doctor, Dr. Mullen?
The debt levels are punishing. The average debt level of a graduating student today is about $140,000. It's like having a mortgage when you leave school that is going to be a major part of your financial future. But the important thing is, and there are debt is incentive, too. It's something that you can use to get people to consider different kinds of careers. The National Health Service Corps, a program that exists, but has always been funded at, I would call it, a demonstration level. There are about 2,000 physicians in the National Health Service Corps today. We have 800,000 physicians in the country, so it's modest. It is earmarked, slated for increases. The stimulus package provided money, and in the healthcare reform discussions, there is talk about greatly increasing the National Health Service Corps. And the deal there is that students commit to it and either receive a scholarship during school, for which they have obligation for working in shortage areas in primary care, or at the time they finish their training, if they want to go to a shortage area in primary care, there's loan repayment. So that's the kind of positive incentive that needs to be greatly increased. but it's all along the board. You need to do things with medical students, mm-hmm. with residents, and in practice.
Dr. Groper, you've heard the president talk about reforming the entire healthcare system. Are any of the plans that you see out there encouraging young people once again, as they did in that 94-98 period, are they there once again to encourage people to go into primary care?
I think there's a lot less certainty around this discussion about where healthcare reform or the healthcare system might move in the next several years. A lot of the discussions that have taken place on the Hill, what we've seen in the Global House package that came out of the tri-committee chairs, really focuses more on insurance reform, coverage reform. But I will say that there are key provisions in there that really do invest in programs like the National Health Service Corps. They invest in trying to pay people who do cognitive work more and more fairly. They also try to help create incentives to create medical homes or other new practice environments. There's a great bill out there from Allison Schwartz of Pennsylvania, who has 117 co-sponsors in the House that is a bill to revitalize primary care. It takes care of the need to actually train more physicians, to actually pay them more fairly, and to help really create a better practice environment.
There is a huge issue, and that is with malpractice insurance. Dr. Ray, how did you find your own situation as a pediatrician? What was the impact of the amount of malpractice insurance you had to carry?
Well, Diane, to be perfectly honest, I'm in a low-risk specialty, pediatrics. It's not like neurosurgery or cardiac surgery or OBGYN. So my premiums were high compared to my risk, I felt. But I never let that really bother me. But I talked to, in my medical leadership career, I've talked to so many of my colleagues that know that it is a very onerous burden to carry. And in our survey, this was one of the things that physicians found most disturbing about their medical practice environment was the legal issues that were associated with the constant threat.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Do you want to say something about malpractice, Dr. Groper?
I think that, you know, what's often missed in the malpractice discussion is that the concerns over the price of liability insurance are real. The concerns over having caps on non-economic damages are real. But think about physicians and their attitudes towards their patients and towards the practice of medicine. What we fail to recognize often is not so much that physicians are worried about the extent of an adverse action against them. They don't like getting sued. They don't want to worry about that day in and day out. They want to do the right things for their patients. But I think they're often forced to do a whole lot of things that they might otherwise not be doing in a system where they didn't have that concern.
You mean more tests, more
defensive medicine. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's also a layer of complexity and, you know, documentation that's required as well.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Marta. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane. I'm a physician. I used to be a primary care. I switched to another specialty. And my major reason was I practice in San Antonio. I don't think the government or the people in the U.S. put enough emphasis of taking care of the health. They don't take care. You have a diabetic that don't do the diet, don't do exercise, and that's very frustrating for primary care. That's my point.
That's very interesting, Dr. Groper.
I think Marta brings out a great point here, but part of it is that we haven't actually helped to facilitate people's self-care and prevention. We have not emphasized it in this nation. And one of the reasons that when you look at other international studies that show that OECD countries, you know, Scandinavian countries have much better health outcomes in terms of things like life expectancy, infant mortality, etc., they put a whole lot more investment, not in health care per se, but in building the social safety net in public health. They spend far more than we do if you combine health care and social spending. We've never done that.
Here's an email from Heather who says, my husband left primary care after 7 years as a family practice doctor. He was tired of the constant pressure to see a patient every 15 minutes. He didn't feel he could give his patients the care they needed. Also, he was working 70-plus hours a week, was physically exhausted from the pace. Will the president's health care plan change how primary care is delivered? The English system pays doctors by the number of patients they have rather than how many patients a doctor sees in a day. Very briefly, Dr. Mullen.
Capitation is the term to which she refers, which many societies do. We do in some of our health systems, and that's pay per head, as it were. And that's a very good system for organizing care and for controlling costs. In case of primary care, it helps build a strong base.
Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen of George Washington University. More of your calls and emails when we return.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by this and other NPR stations, and by American University, by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids, families, and communities succeed at aecf.org, and by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Democrat Al Franken heads to Washington after Republican Norm Coleman concedes the contested Minnesota Senate race. What Franken's victory means for the balance of power on Capitol Hill and the president's agenda. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And for our guests, here's a tweet. Why not just allow four-year undergraduate degrees for primary care doctors, as in the United Kingdom, and or more nurse practitioners? Problem solved.
I'm not sure what the reference is to four-year undergraduate. Just to respond to that, people think that primary care is... In some settings, people think primary care is not as difficult or not as tough, and anyone can do it. In fact, the complexity of primary care, the uncertainty, the requirement to know something about physical health, mental health, community health, public health is very demanding and requires special training. So demoting primary care is not the answer to make it more available. We do have nurse practitioners and physician assistants, two American inventions. both coming out of the 1960s, both now mature professional cadres who are very active. There are about 100,000 nurse practitioners, about 70,000 physician assistants in practice today. In primary care, nurse practitioners more in primary care, physician assistants more in specialty care. In the judgment of many, myself included, they are part of the answer to the future in terms of sustaining.
How so?
Well, there's a great concern about we will not have enough physicians if we give everybody health insurance, if we continue to age as we hope we continue to do. And there are challenges of demand coming out of both those. Some people say that we should continue to build a doctor workforce like we have built, which is highly subspecialized, very top-heavy with proceduralists, and not very efficient and not very cost-effective in terms of all kinds of global measurements. We are costing ourselves our family treasure. But the use of non-physician clinicians with physicians in both specialty and general fields is a very important way to build the future.
Here's an email from Elizabeth. She says, writing from Meredith, New Hampshire, when I lived in New York City, I was under the care of a nurse practitioner group and never had better care. There is a dearth of family care physicians in New Hampshire and specialists. Would not having groups of nurse practitioners spaced throughout sparsely populated areas of any state heal the problem? Perhaps this would encourage and enlarge this group of highly educated people. Dr. Grover.
I think there's absolutely room for using other health professionals. We need to do it. But remember, we have an overall nursing shortage that started to abate. We can't develop nurse practitioners without nurses. And so we have a challenge in all human resources in healthcare. We're going to need to expand greatly. We expect a shortage of no fewer than 120,000 physicians by the year 2025. There's also going to continue to be shortages of nurses and PAs. We do need to figure out how to do things more efficiently, do them in teams. And in some cases, yes, we will have to use alternative models of care, particularly for underserved populations, whether they're in rural or urban communities.
All right. Let's go now to Greg in Detroit, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes. I'm a primary care physician, and I did private practice and office space for about 5-6 years. I agree with the panelists that it is just grueling and you don't get any personal time. Then switched over to home visits, and I've been doing that for about 7 years now. And it's a wonderful thing. That's probably the best move, and I'm just curious if there's any input in the works through the Medical Society regarding advancing that idea and pushing it more and more as time goes on.
Dr. Grover.
You know, I think we are trying to look at how to create alternative sites of care. We want to keep people in the community more and more often. It's difficult to have patients come into the office. I think the real difficulty is how do you pay for this? And one model is boutique or concierge medicine, where patients are actually paying the difference. They're paying a retainer to have that kind of access. I think most of us in medicine don't want to pursue that kind of model. Add to that the fact that we already spend so much on healthcare. Where are we going to find that new money? It's a real challenge. But I think we need to be a little more innovative in how we think about providing care, where we provide the care, and who provides the care.
To Rochester, New York, and to Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in your guest's views on the National Service Corps. I'm actually a National Service Corps scholar as a medical student here in Rochester, and I find it to be a wonderful way of dealing with the financial constraints of medical school. It directs you towards primary care fields, and it also applies to many other healthcare professionals as well. So I haven't heard a lot of this mentioned on any sort of radio program, so I'd just like to get a little feedback there.
Dr. Mullen.
I had the privilege of being a National Service Corps doctor at one point. I ran the National Service Corps at another point, and the caller is right on target. It is a unsung American gem, and the principle is basically community service in return for having your medical education debt either paid for or reduced significantly.
And what's the obligation?
You incur essentially a year-for-year obligation. That is, if you get your medical school paid for in a scholarship for 2 years, you have 2 years of obligation. Loan repayment goes on a year-for-year basis, help you to pay down your $140,000 or whatever it might be that you've incurred while in medical school. But the principle is that it supports primary care, and it supports physicians and other health professionals in shortage areas, called health profession shortage areas, which we have every
throughout
state in the country, throughout the country, urban and rural, north and south. And it is really allows a medical student to pursue what they want to do. And certainly if their sense is one of service, they both get to serve in a discipline that they want to do, primary care, and to do it in with populations that they probably couldn't afford to serve if they had to do it on a fee-for-service basis. And this is government at its best. It's enabling people to actualize what they want to do and serve in a way that really meets national needs.
Brian, does that answer your question?
Yes, yes. I just feel that, community service is part and parcel with the medical profession. I mean, a lot of people, I think, have kind of skewed motivations for going into medicine, and I've always prided myself on being very involved in the community. I'm a former AmeriCorps member, and so it was very important for me when I was making my decision to go to medical school that I had these opportunities to do good works in communities that really need help.
I'm glad you called.
I think Brian makes a terrific point. The question is, who goes into medicine? What kind of community service background or proclivities do they have? We've always used tests that select for scientific proficiency, and that is important. We want our folks to have, our doctors to have a scientific basis, but also having a community spirit, a sense of service, and a purpose in medicine that harkens back to the roots of medicine is very important, and Brian's got it. We salute you, Brian.
Thanks for calling, Brian. Congratulations. Here's an email from Jess, who is an MPH student at the George Washington University. What does MPH stand for?
Master's in Public Health.
Thank you. Okay. He says, what are the prospects of switching to a salaried system as demonstrated by the Mayo Clinic? Wouldn't that encourage more people to go into primary care more often? Dr. Ray. Dr. Ray, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to address the overall problem, if I could, for a minute, of the shortage of primary care.
No, well, hold on just a minute, Dr. Ray. I asked a particular question posed by a caller named Jess, who is a public health student at GW here in Washington. He says, what are the prospects of switching to a salaried system as demonstrated by the Mayo Clinic? Wouldn't that encourage more people to go into primary care more often?
I'd like to pass to one of my colleagues on that, and then I'd like you to come back to me so I can have a little time to discuss a couple of issues that I think you're listeners would be very interested in.
Okay, sir. Go ahead, Dr. Grover.
Well, the Mayo Clinic is a terrific example that we have tried to figure out how to replicate in other areas. You know, the Mayo brothers started this real sort of different kind of social construct years ago. It's difficult to replicate. But what we do know is that we already often cross-subsidize the income of primary care physicians, particularly in our teaching hospitals and our faculty practice plans. But it's very difficult to do when you're competing with a marketplace that then specialists will say, hey, I can go make more money on the outside. Now, I think we do know that integration is the key to really developing a better healthcare system and replicating that kind of Mayo or Geisinger model across the country. We have a lot of barriers to doing that, including some regulatory barriers such as the Stark rules, antitrust issues that make it more difficult in some other areas. And also in areas with multiple medical systems, it becomes more complex and difficult when patients can then go easily between one group and another.
But the principle that Dr. Grover mentions is an important one. That is, we will never get anywhere in healthcare reform, and we will never rein in our runaway costs if we don't have a better organized system. Mayo is an excellent example of an academically based organized system. The primary care medical home that we touched on is an example building from the ground up. This is the direction that healthcare reform needs to go. This is the direction the system as a whole needs to go that will support not only general care, but primary care in particular.
But is the president's approach at this point focused primarily on the insurance question?
The marquee issue is the insurance question, the battle, the bloodletting is going on over that. There are a number of subsidiary issues, of which workforce is one, that are getting good airtime. They're getting hearings, they're getting attention, they're getting legislative proposals. I think the challenge for all of us who are Congress watchers is, will they keep those as part of the package?
I see.
And will they really put money behind primary care salaries, behind primary care medical homes, behind the National Health Service Corps, behind teaching health centers and other ways to get teaching and primary care into the communities? Those are the key issues, and we've got to watch them carefully.
Dr. Bray, you want to comment?
I'd just like to emphasize, back to the global question of the shortage of primary care, we have some interesting information from the survey about the medical practice environment. We ask 270,000 family practitioners and primary care physicians what their plans were in the next 1 to 3 years, and it was startling. 150,000, half of them, said that they plan to make substantial changes in their practice over the next 3 years. 10 to 12% said they plan to retire. 10 to 12% said that they plan to seek a job within health care but not seeing patients. They would become a medical director for a nursing home or a hospital or perhaps work for a pharmaceutical company. Another 10 to 12% said that they would seek a job totally outside of medicine. And then the remaining 15% were evenly split between what we mentioned a minute ago, concierge medicine or boutique medicine, where you see less patients and give them more time, and locum tenens, where you're not as productive. If all of this occurs, there will be a tremendous exodus from the practice of primary care. And this is not, no matter what you do at the level of the medical students to encourage them, it's not going to work, because word gets back to them that physicians are not recommending primary care is the place to be. The point for our listeners is, how can health care reform be successful when you are increasing access to care and ensuring the uninsured, if they're not physicians there to see them? In other words, increasing access to care is increasing insurance coverage is wonderful, but if they can't get to see a doctor, there's the problem.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And one last caller in Durham, North Carolina. Charles, you're on the air.
Hello. Well, the point I'd like to bring up is, I have yet to see from the medical profession them actually behaving like a profession. They've lost the moral high ground. You know, they sit here and they whine constantly about not having enough time to see patients and how that hurts their patients, maybe kills some of them. They dump people off to the ER. They don't follow up with results from testing from other specialists. All this stuff, if they were standing up and saying, this is malpractice, this is not practicing medicine, if they established a moral high ground that their patients could get behind, they would have massive support for any of the reforms they wanted to do. But they've given up on their profession, and people are giving up on them. They look at them, they're just another business. They're like going down and getting our car worked on.
Dr. Crover.
You know, I think professionalism is something that we have tried to return to in the last several years. It's a difficult thing to teach, but we try and do it. And I think the caller has some real valid concerns about the way that we behave in the medical profession. And I think that part of it is reinforced by a system that I think incentivizes some not terrific behavior on the part of physicians. And also remember that, you know, a third of physicians are in primary care. That's been the same way for the last 30 years. But even the primary care physicians may not have always the same exact point of view. And so you're right, there needs to be better alignment between physicians themselves as well as the patients that they serve. And it's something that we've struggled with for quite a while.
Dr. Mullen.
I would agree that Charles has concerns which we all feel as patients, the medical profession has not always represented itself in the way one might like to see. The AMA, our spokesman over the years, has often fought things like Medicare lost it, even though it benefited the country. And we look for leadership even now. But I will say, if you look across countries, those countries that have a broader, better primary care base show both more satisfaction from patient perspectives, as well as lower costs and better outcomes. And you can do similar analyses across states or regions in the United States. Primary care areas with a more robust primary care representation do better in terms of all of the metrics, satisfaction, cost, and quality. So there's a lesson there. People think that, gee, if I've got a neurosurgeon at my beck and call, I'm probably in a great area. That may be true, but having two or three neurosurgeons may not improve the quality of your care. But if you don't have a primary care doc, you can be sure your care isn't going
to
be good.
That cross-state comparison is really interesting. It gets back to the point that we made before about cross-national comparisons. What's interesting is some states that actually spend more money on specialty care and Medicare, spend less money through Medicaid, take less good care of patients from the age of birth to the age of 65, have higher poverty rates, have higher numbers of minorities, and it's a very complex picture.
Dr. Atul Grover of the Association of American Medical Colleges, Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen of the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, and Dr. Walker Ray. He's vice president for the Physicians Foundation, a retired pediatrician after 38 years of practice in Atlanta. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.